everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and I'm here today with my co-host Tim Hemming to do another one of our Tuesday's news roundup. Not weekly, but when necessary, we'd like to think. So Tim, what's the first very necessary, very important news point we have for today?
Morning, Jen. Thank you for having me back on my own show. very necessary. So there's a lot of Brexit news happening this week. And with the first place to start has got to be with the negotiation position papers. There's five new ones going to be put out this week, which may or may not get us anywhere. But the five areas of negotiation that will be covered are firstly on goods and services. So that's the plan for the most frictionless trade possible for both goods and services, which the UK will argue should be discussed as they're inseparable. The second one is the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, which is probably one of the biggest ones, I think. There's been quite a lot of debate about this already. Proposals for dispute resolution between the EU and the UK in light of the ECJ no longer having jurisdiction in Britain. And then there's also the civil judicial cooperation paper. That's a separate position paper that's going to detail how the UK foresees the cooperation with the EU when it comes to civil law. Then there's a couple more on data and confidentiality, which is the movement of data seen as crucial to many international businesses, and data protection as a whole is becoming a much bigger issue. Confidentiality is details for plans ensuring documents and information exchange between the UK and other EU countries will continue to be exchanged with protection. So a lot to get our teeth stuck into, and the Prime Minister's just returned from her three-week holiday, so she's back in Downing Street. And this next week, Davis, the Brexit Secretary, heads to Brussels for the next formal rounds of negotiations. So we're getting this information out in the public domain. Now, because of the delay on formal positions of two key demands from European negotiators, that's one on citizens' rights and financial settlement, there are cabinet ministers concerned that the EU 27 states could delay a decision on whether to progress to negotiating a future trade deal and put it back by at least 2 months. So what have we got from Mr. Davis on this at the moment? He's saying that his department will be putting forward imaginative and creative solutions to build a deep and special partnership with our closest neighbours and allies. It's not really
bit of a weak statement, yeah.
Yeah,
well, doesn't really mean anything, does it?
It's, the devil is always in the detail, and it's not necessarily coming from David Davis. But he went on to say, in the coming days, we'll demonstrate our thinking even further with five new papers, and it's all part of our work to drive the talks forward. They want to drive towards trade deals, and the EU are digging their heels in because we can't reach agreement on other areas. And he's also, David Davis, I think, also here is saying that the clock is ticking and it's in the EU's best interests to try and come to the table on this as well. So I guess this is where we have the negotiation standoffs happening. And you interviewed a negotiator for an episode, was it last week's episode?
Or Tuesday.
Find out about how negotiations Tuesdays. Should be done then. Then go back and have a listen to that one. Obviously, all of the government's position was shouted down as normal by the opposing parties. Tom Brake from the Lib Dems said, it had finally dawned that we're careering towards the edge of an economic precipice, hence the government's desperation to try to move on to discussing our future relationship with the EU. But with the EU citizens still uncertain about their family's future, a huge question mark over the Irish border, no movement on the settlement bill, it's all going to fall on deaf ears. There's the other problem. Michel Barnier, the EU's top negotiator, will be the man who ultimately decides when the trade talks actually start, when sufficient progress has been made in Brussels. But there are other things on the horizon as well. The German election, which you'll know all about, Jen, happens next month.
In September, yeah.
Yeah, so, and then again, that could put Brexit talks on standby for 2 months. Has there been, you're in Berlin recently, is there much chatter about the upcoming election?
There is a lot going on at the moment. You can see the posters everywhere, and there's a lot of, I think, division about where to go from here. I think it's a very similar thing to Brexit and to the US in a way, because I think while Merkel's almost certainly going to get re-elected, it's sort of about who the third in the running is going to be, the third party, the third biggest. So that's going to be one of the smaller parties, so that could veer right or that could veer left. And I think a lot of people right now are deciding whether they just sort of want to vote against the establishment and just sort of shake up what's happening. So I think that it's going to be really interesting to see who that third party is going to be, whether it's going to be someone like the left and the country goes a bit more in that direction, or whether it's going to be like something like Alternative for Germany, which is sort of the UKIP equivalent of Germany. So it could go either way at this point, really. But I think Merkel's almost certainly going to get re-elected, although obviously not with a governing majority.
And does that third, the third party in Germany have any influence?
It would, yeah, because it would be, Germany would then be governed by a coalition, so they would have not complete say, but it would sort of have, I would say, similar repercussions maybe to the DUP being important to Theresa May's ability to govern here. So they would have some sway on issues that are really important to them, because obviously they'll be able to push back on that and say, we won't vote for your issues if you don't push through ours. So
sure, okay, watch this space on Germany. So and you, and on our second point, it follows on closely from the papers coming out this week. You wanted to have
exactly
a look at Slovenia,
as we just suggested. Basically, obviously, our government wants to move ahead trade deal negotiations as soon as possible. We've said this entire time, but the EU has been really steadfast on saying we're having these opening negotiations first, which we're currently in the process of, and then we're going to progress onto trade negotiations. But as was probably to be expected from the somewhat standstill that we're experiencing at the moment, where we don't really have any concrete outcomes, no really moving together of the different points of view. So the first first official from the EU has now come out and said that they think trade negotiations will not happen anytime soon. And that was the Prime Minister of Slovenia, Mr. Miro Cerar, I'm going to say, is how you pronounce that. C-E-R-A-R, for the record. He said in an interview with The Guardian that the UK has just not come any way towards the EU and its stances on citizens' rights, the financial settlement and the Irish border, and that's why he thinks that just basically it's not going to happen until the beginning of next year at the earliest. So, for example, the UK has refused to name any sum of money that they would be willing to pay in the divorce bill, so the UK is really just unmoving in a few of these issues, apparently. And basically, Mr. Cerar sits on the European Council, which will be the body that in October will decide, based on recommendations by Michael Barnier, whether we can move along to trade talks or not. And he's, of course, only one of the 27 ministers on that council that will make the decision, but obviously it doesn't bode well that he's already come out in public and said that he doesn't think it will happen.
Okay.
Just to add on to that,
okay.
The UK has obviously been really resistant to sort of splitting out these sort of priority issues that have been set aside from the future trade deal negotiations. So David Davis has said in the Sunday Times that he thinks things, for example, like the Irish border talks and future trade deals are inextricably linked, and you can't really separate those two from each other. So really we should be discussing it at the same time. So at this point, it's basically not even just disagreements about the issues themselves, but also disagreement about how the trade deal negotiations should happen in the first place. So lots of disagreement there, but it's basically almost impossible for EU chief negotiator Michael Barnier to move on this, because he has a very fixed negotiation mandate from the EU, because obviously all 27 member states need to agree on how negotiations are going to happen. So the EU, as we know, is not a very flexible organization, and they're not going to be flexible on how negotiations happen. So that is a bit of a standstill there on a lot of fronts.
Que sera, cara. Whatever will be, will be. We're leaving the EU, you see, Jen. Okay, so let's move it on to point three. And one group of people who are pretty united, it seems, over Brexit
At least one group.
Yeah. Are the Anguillans, who feel they could be facing economic ruin in the event of a hard Brexit. Do you know where Anguilla is?
No, I do not, Tim. Please do enlighten me.
I will. Anguilla is a very small Caribbean island, an island of 35 square miles that's home to 15,000 British citizens. And there has been some chatter that it could hold the key for the border dispute with Northern Ireland. It's probably got about as much in common with Northern Ireland as, I don't know, maybe mainland Britain, judging by the way Westminster treats Northern Ireland. But Anguilla's nearest neighbour is the French Overseas Collectivity of St Martin, which is considered by the EU as one of its outermost regions. And it also has a relationship with, so its relationship with Dutch St Martin, its close neighbour, could be jeopardised when we come out of the European Union. The government of Anguilla, the ruling body of Anguilla, and I'm sure it's called the government, but the ruling party there, they issued a white paper to say that this symbiotic relationship with its European neighbours is its only means of survival. About 90% of the island's fuel, which is used to effectively process the drinking water, comes via the Dutch territory, St Martin, and officials are dismayed by the attitude of Whitehall and neglected by all, and they feel neglected by British politicians. So they've launched a charm offensive with Europe, and they put out this white paper on potential solutions to Britain's forgotten EU border. So it proposes a Schengen-style common travel area between the three territories, a local customs union, and continued collaboration between the EU and UK on funding local projects. If the idea is accepted by Brussels, perhaps it could provide a blueprint for the compromise on the island situation. Government spokesman said, "We are engaging closely with overseas territories and will continue to make sure their interests are taken into account." Not that the Anguillans necessarily believe them. So I had a look at a bit of a dive into the white paper that they produced on the subject and found out that Anguilla has been British since 1650. And is the only British overseas territory in history that fought Britain to remain British and succeeded in the Anguillan Revolution.
So the British were like, "We don't want you," and the Anguillans were like, "We want to stay with you."
Yeah, and which they could well be regretting that now.
They are probably.
Possibly, maybe.
Bless them.
That was 40 years ago. Agat was against Harold Wilson's government, 67 to 69. And it's of strategic... as important strategically as the gateway to the Panama Canal that connects the Atlantic Pacific. So 20% of the world's shipping passes through Anguillan waters that reside under the control of the government of Anguilla. So important, right? This is all in the white paper. It has direct borders with France and Holland, which are the EU member states, as we discussed previously, and therefore it's heavily dependent on both of these nations for the essential commodities and services that include fuel, international access, basic medical general services, such as MRIs, scanning, dentistry, post. And each evening at 10 o'clock, the French close down the border, effectively cutting the islands off. The only where it gets its development aid from is from the EU.
It's quite ironic, really, that Anguilla thinks it's being disregarded because, I mean, the devolved governments of Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland already think this, so I can't even imagine how the Anguillans must be feeling. Completely underrepresented, bless them.
Yeah, cut off and go out to sea. Yes, they're probably, and the Gibraltans, and
at least maybe the weather there is nice, you know, get mood, maybe.
Yeah. So, and to kind of compound it, the UK regards Anguilla as ineligible for support from the Department for International Development. So it's only provided nominal support even when Anguilla was deemed eligible. And despite having a lower GDP than other recipients of the funding, it's ranked 22nd in the world for good governance and financial transparency, which is quite good for islands because they do get they do get hit with the stick of being money laundering capitals. It's difficult, right, when you're a small island. and it feels that it suffers from the most outdated constitution of all British overseas territories, and it compromises the effectiveness of its democratically appointed government. So Victor Banks, who's the chief minister, finishes it with a plea, which is, our ultimate aim is to ensure that Anguilla is put in a position where its reliance upon neighbouring islands and countries is greatly reduced. This, we argue, can be achieved by providing us with extended and upgraded airport facilities, upgraded port facilities, and a hospital that is capable of comprehensive delivery of primary and secondary care for our people and the many thousands that visit us each year who support the main driver of our economy, tourism. In the furtherance of this objective, an infrastructural advisor funded by the UK has been contracted for the next 2 years. However, it is imperative that a timely implementation is applied to avoid the predictable risk of the suffering of the people of Anguilla as a direct consequence of Brexit.
Interesting difference in issues there. Again, we're debating, should we keep the NHS and free healthcare for everyone? They're debating, can we please get a singular hospital on this island?
Have you ever been to the Caribbean?
I wish I had. I have not. Mm. What, do they generally not have hospitals? Is that where...
No, they... all the islands are quite independent, quite different. But
yeah.
I'm wondering whether we should jump on a flight out to Anguilla.
I think that sounds like a great plan. I think a group of people that's definitely not as united on any of this as the Anguillans is mainland British population, because...
And what evidence do you have for that?
I have some polling news for everyone.
Okay, point
I still
four.
Think we should get a jingle for polling news. Polling! Woo! Anyway, and a poll by The Observer and Opinion found that 37% of people think we should prioritise ending free movement, while 38% think we should prioritise staying in the single market. So that's a pretty even split there, which is once again underlining the fact that while we voted for Brexit, not even by a very big margin, no one really knows what that would look like. So really, we're having two very opposing views there on saying ending free movement, I believe, is the most important thing.
Right, okay.
Or staying in the single market is the most important thing, which are sort of opposing. I don't think we're going to get both of them at the same time. That's just not really possible.
And that was the same poll that produced those results?
Yeah, basically. And it's also another interesting thing is that I think the idea has been floating around a lot recently that there should maybe be a second referendum because of the entire mess that the beginning of this negotiation period has been. So I think you would just expect
more people... I'm sure the Liberal Democrats would say that idea has been floating around for the past 12 months.
It has, but I think it's gotten a lot more salience recently. I've read a lot of articles, a lot of comment pieces on a lot of different publications debating whether or not this is a good idea or not. But it seems that people are not really that divided. I think almost half of respondents believe that there should not be a second referendum, which is the majority there.
Must be more than half.
This was just in that poll. I believe it's probably more than half.
Yeah, most people are just saying, let's get on with it.
I think it's mainly political commentators debating, could we do this? But I don't think that it is logistically actually possible. I just don't think it's really an option. And then another last little tidbit is that fewer people now trust in Theresa May and her Conservatives to lead negotiations. In June, it was 39%, and this month, it's only 33% of people that trust the government to run these negotiations, which is an incredibly tiny number, considering that these are the most important negotiations that this generation of people is ever going to have. This is so decisive, and we just don't trust the government that's there.
Was the initial figure before the election, then?
I believe it would have been.
Yeah.
It was also, I believe...
So the falling majority of the Tories is probably going to play into that, and also the fact that we've been at negotiations now for a good number of weeks, and we still don't seem to have anything concrete in place.
Yeah, and I think the general sort of likability of Theresa May has also declined recently. So especially since Grenfell and the way she sort of handled the terror attacks and things like that, I think. There were some stats that said that she was now less popular than before. Maybe not less popular than Jeremy Corbyn, because because as we know, there is a very big grudge against him. But yeah.
There is?
I think for a lot of people there is. I think there's quite a big media bias against him as well still.
Yeah, from right-wing press, definitely.
Not just...
I think he was bringing his groundswell of public opinion and his...
I think he's definitely gaining ground, especially since the election, but I think opinions are still divided, in the left as well, about whether he should be the one leading the party and whether he's too far left and alienating centrist voters and... Yeah, I think that's a whole...
Or a general lack of clarity about what he stands for. We had Paul Goldsmith on and talking about where Jeremy Corbyn does actually stand on Brexit. But it is still kind of confusing. It brings us to our final point, which was Labour's Chaka Emana Huke, who was trying to distance the Labour Party's position from the Tories on Brexit. There's got to be clear red water between our position, the Labour Party's position, and Theresa May's extreme jobs-destroying Brexit position. He mentioned that on the Radio 4 Today programme. To my mind, that means we absolutely do need to be arguing for the UK to remain a member of the single market and also of the customs union after we leave the European Union. So, unfortunately, when he was pushed on whether that was the frontbencher's view, whether that was Jeremy Corbyn's view, all he could come up with was the frontbench position is that, in the end, the ultimate goal here is if you want to have a relationship which puts jobs first and doesn't damage the economy. So, they want to have a relationship that puts jobs first and doesn't damage the economy, yet they won't actually say
what that position specifically entails. Yeah. So that's both of our political parties not being particularly clear about what they want, which is, I mean, I suppose I reflective of the country in general.
I think the Tories are clearer, though, aren't they?
Slightly clearer, although I don't think they've been completely open about every aspect of this either. I think they've been quite vague still. So I do think that is reflective of the country in general. Do you not? That it's just not... Nobody knows what the majority wants because there is no majority that wants anything. It's all little split groups that thinks maybe we should do it this way, maybe we should do it this way, maybe this is the best, because there's also so many variables at play that there's no way you can even have a comprehensive view on all of them, I think.
I think the two main things are the split between trade and the movement of people. That seems to be one of the biggest issues.
Yeah.
And that's all the Brexit news we have for you today. Do check back on Thursday and next week, as always, for any more Brexit news and opinions that you might need. I've been your host, Jennifer Han, here with my co-host, Tim Hemming, who is also my co-producer on the show, along with Warren Paul. Our theme song is brought to you by Kevin MacLeod, and we hope you'll be joining us again soon.